technology.
Okay, thanks, Jorge. So I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing with Abhay Ashtekar and Ivan Aguijo here at the IGC in Penn State. And this is following on for the talk that Ivan gave here at the ILQG on the 29th of March. So if you all go to slide number 2. And start off by talking about sort of what is done in standard inflation. And by that I mean inflation in GR. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but I'm really focusing a lot on how perturbations are generated and really what the conceptual difficulties are, what the questions we think we should be able to answer in a quantum gravity theory are. Then I'll talk a bit about Hamiltonian perturbations in cosmology. And as we'll see, this is actually a very nice and sort of clean way of doing perturbations in cosmology, and it's fortunate that that's not how you see it in textbooks. Then I'm going to briefly, if I have time, sketch some of the basic ideas behind QFT in quantum spacetimes. And this is really the seminal work by Ashtekar, Kaminsky, and Lewandowski. And since I think all three of them are in the audience, I'll be quite brief and try not to make too many mistakes. And then on the fourth point, once we've built up this machinery, we should be able to see sort of immediately how to do apply this for perturbations in LQC. So we'll do that and really try and tackle some of the conceptual difficulties that we had in inflation and see what this new approach has told us about these difficulties. And then at the end, which I want to spend a good 5 or 10 minutes on, is really pointing out that in addition to this being sort of conceptually satisfactory and sort of finishing up some of the inflation scenario, you can also do honest-to-God calculations and get sort of potential observables out of it, which makes it very exciting. So I should also say, please interrupt me at any time if you have any questions. I don't guarantee I'll answer them, but you should feel free to ask. So if we all go to slide number 3, so this is the sort of basics of inflation. And really the only thing I'm interested about inflation, and the reason it's so interesting at all, is that it gives you a mechanism for creating the perturbations that seed the inhomogeneities we see in the universe. And you get this mechanism basically for free. Really what happens is that the quantum fluctuations of the scalar perturbations that come naturally get amplified by the background expansion. So inflation is this exponential expansion of the background, and these quantum fluctuations on this expansion amplify the scale of these perturbations so that they're observable. And what's really nice about it is that you can quantify this very precisely, you can calculate it, and you can go and check against observation whether or not the statistics agree, and indeed they do to a very high accuracy. So the thing that's normally used to measure it is the power spectrum, or the observable power spectrum. So I should say here, so I'm later on I'll be referring to scalar perturbations by the letter Q, but when you look in the cosmology literature, you'll see the variable R everywhere, and these two things are just related by this simple expression in equation 1. And the power spectrum is defined as you take your operator corresponding to your scalar perturbations, R, you take its two-point expectation value in respect to some state, so that's the left-hand side of equation 1. Then you notice that homogeneity and isotropy of the background require this to be a delta function in the k's. So we're working in k space, so this is after Fourier transforming it. And so then this absolute value of R squared is really the power spectrum. But it's much more convenient to work with something that's dimensionless, so you factor out a kq, and then you factor out a 4 pi because it's convenient for the integrals. And so this thing in red on the right-hand side, which is delta subscript r squared, this is the power spectrum. This is the number that you see from WMAP and all the data is restricting this. And you can go and calculate this. So in slow roll inflation, which is the standard scalar field inflation scenario in GR, you can go ahead and calculate this. And for an expansion that's almost a sitter, so this is what slow roll inflation really is. This power spectrum has this very nice property that if you evaluate it late enough times, it's a constant, and it doesn't matter what time you've evaluated it at. So the way I've written it here in equation 2 is this power spectrum for some mode k, evaluated at some time later than some time tk, which is defined below, is given by this expression here. And the details of the expression don't matter. I should say that epsilon here is the slow roll parameter. So really that's a parameter that tells you how far away from the city you are, or tells you how much the h, which is the Hubble parameter, is varying. The only thing you really need to know about equation 2 is that there's no explicit dependence on k. So there is this power spectrum is almost independent of k. And indeed it would be completely independent of k if this tk variable was the same for all modes. The tk is really the time at which that mode exited the horizon, or if you're being a bit more precise, it'd be the time at which the wavelength is comparable to the curvature scale, which is the same in GR. The two statements are the same in general relativity, but not in quantum theory. So TK is sort of given by the expression underneath equation 2, which is when H, the Hubble radio, or the Hubble parameter, and the wavelength of this mode K are approximately inverses of each other. So if we go to slide number 4, this almost scale invariant is a very important sort of feature of slow roll inflation. And it's the almost is almost as important as the fact that it's scale invariant at all. So you parameterize how close it is to scale invariance by something that's called the spectral tilt, NS, or usually 1 minus NS is the thing that's used. So equation 3 is the definition of NS. It's really just the logarithmic derivative of the power spectrum with respect to K. And you can calculate it during slow roll. So equation 3, the right-hand approximation, is calculated for a phi squared potential. And this epsilon, again, is the same slow roll parameter. And then the key point of all this is honest actual observations. So WMAP satellites have been flying around for 7 years and taking exceptional data, and they've been able to measure these numbers very precisely. And I apologize, there is a minus sign missing on the NS minus 1 equation, so that really should be minus 0.032. And the only thing to take away from here is that the error bars are quite small. I mean, in particular, on the power spectrum, the error bars are really very small. On the spectral tilt, they're percentage-wise quite large, but it's still very obvious that there is a spectral tilt, and it's all very much in agreement with slow roll. The only thing that's just for your information is the WMAP data is all measured at a particular value of K, which is just convenient for observation. So it's called K star, and it's 0.02 inverse megaparsecs. And really, this is all sort of standard stuff. This is all the background. And what I want you to get from this is that this is what we're aiming for. If we have some theory that we're going to try and embed inflation in and complete the whole process, then we need to make sure we get this back out, because this is real physics, it's observations, and this is what we're aiming for. Of course, ideally we'd be aiming for something that agrees with this within error bars, but is not quite the same as standard GR, so you could actually make a prediction and see if you could test it in the future. Okay, so we'll go on to slide number 5. So inflation is very good, and it does a lot of great things, but there are some sort of very deep conceptual questions that are really open issues in inflation, and I've sort of broadly grouped them into two categories here. So one I've been calling particle physics issues, and these are things like, what is the scalar field? I mean, it's all well and good to postulate it, but we haven't seen one ever, so what is this? For the inflation to work, for slow roll inflation to work, the potential needs to I've written it here as be flat, but in general it's the scalar field needs to have some almost time symmetry, time invariant symmetry. So why does that happen? And it turns out to be extremely difficult to get either of these things from any ground unified particle physics theory. So string theory, you get lots of scalar fields, but getting any of them with a potential of the right form to give you inflation is extremely difficult. And then on a much more practical level, if we have a scalar field, I mean, how are we going to couple it to the rest of the particles that we see around us? And how are we going to couple it to the standard model? And the details of this are actually very important, even for inflation itself, because somehow inflation has to end and presumably gives back all its energy into the standard model. And this process of reheating is extremely ill understood and very difficult to get a handle on. And the thing I want to emphasize about these are very important questions, but they're kind of not in the remit of quantum gravity. I mean, in the stuff we're doing, we're looking to understand how to quantize gravity, but we're not trying to put it in a grand unified theory that has all the particle physics in there. So it seems very unlikely that we'd be able to even approach any of those questions within, say, loop quantum cosmology or loop quantum gravity. I say in passing that that's not necessarily the case. There's some really exciting ideas about how, for example, the Barbera-Mitsu parameter might become a scalar field. But for the most part, it seems that we're going to put in our particle physics or our matter content, and that's just the same as it would be in GR. We have no reason for specifying one over another. The more important things for us are that inflation comes with a whole series of quantum gravity type issues, which are really issues to do with the breakdown of quantum field theory in curved spacetime because of GR, because you're approaching singularities, because you're approaching Planck scale curvatures. And these are really questions that are very important for the sort of to complete the whole program of inflation, and we really need to be able to tackle them, and we should be able to tackle them. So the type of questions I'm thinking about are the conditions to obtain inflation. So that's just a vague way of saying, why do we arrive at the onset of inflation with the initial conditions correct to get inflation and to get the right amount and the right type of inflation? So that's a big difficulty that, you know, is just an open question in inflation in GR. But if you have a full quantum gravity theory, it really should somehow emerge from a quantum gravity era. In inflation, you see there's a Trans-Planckian problem, which is kind of a word that's used to describe lots of different things. But what I mean it to be is that the observational modes, some of the modes we genuinely observe today and therefore are sort of physically relevant and have observational consequences, were at some point in the beginning of inflation Trans-Planckian in frequency. When you see Trans-Planckian frequencies, you really start to have to worry about why we believe quantum field theory in curved space-time, and we typically that's an indication that we need to start understanding the quantum gravity issues associated with that. Then, of course, there's the singularity, which, we already know from the background level that loop quantum cosmology solves the singularity and replaces it by a bound. So already we can see that, you know, this was always the long hope of quantum gravity, that it would resolve the singularity somehow, and indeed loop quantum cosmology does that. And we need to make sure that, you know, maintains when you include perturbation theory. And in fact, that asks a much sort of deeper question about perturbation theory in general. It's all well and good to say that even during inflation, we have small perturbations relative to the background. But as you approach the singularity, where the background energy density is becoming infinite in GR, why would we think the perturbations are still perturbations? I mean, is it possible the perturbations blow up? Can we still consider the energy density in these inhomogeneous modes as being small compared to the background? And these type of four questions are really quantum gravity issues, and we should really try and tackle them head on if we believe that we have a theory of quantum gravity that can deal with perturbations. And it's really these type of questions that I'm going to try and ask, and we're going to see how far we can get. And in fact, an awful lot of the questions can be answered in more or less detail within loop quantum cosmology. Okay, so we'll go to slide number 6. So let me give you an example of how classical standard inflation can have these problems. So in the previous slides, when I was talking about the power spectrum, I defined it as being, or you take a two-point correlation function between some state, which I labeled by a vacuum state, a zero. But what do I mean by that? What is this? This is, you know, we're doing quantum field theory in curved space-time, and there's no natural vacuum. There's a huge ambiguity in choosing that. So what is it that people normally take? Well, typically people take the Bunch-Davies vacuum, and the Bunch-Davies vacuum is the unique de Sitter vacuum, and they just put it at some time during inflation. And you know, the argument basically goes, well, inflation is almost de Sitter, so maybe this is a reasonable vacuum to take, or reasonable state to take, and it doesn't really matter, and we'll see why it doesn't really matter exactly when I put it, so everything's basically fine. But what happens if I started with a different state? I mean, we have no real reason for choosing that state as opposed to anything else at the beginning of inflation. So what happens if you've chosen something else, say a state with n particles or some spectrum of particles depending on the mode you're interested in? And so this is something that Ivan and his supervisor, Leonard Parker, wrote down last year. And I think this is an extremely important sort of observation that you can do this calculation, you can do it in detail and say, well, how would the power spectrum and the things we observe change if we had a different state at the onset of inflation? And it changes in a very sort of simple way at the end of the day, that on the right-hand side, the superscript 0 in brackets indicates that this is the same thing you would have calculated using the Bunch-Davies vacuum. But you see it gets modified, and it gets modified by, roughly speaking, the number of particles that there are in that mode. And all I want you to notice from this is that means this initial state can have observable consequences. Okay, so it's not something that's completely irrelevant. I mean, this ambiguity can have sort of observational consequences. And to quote David Sloan, every challenge is an opportunity. So this sort of difficulty about this ambiguity really just means that it turns inflation from being something that gives us the initial conditions from which we get perturbation to a giant microscope, which allows us to really zoom in on the Planck era. In that if we can put some constraints on what this initial vacuum or this initial state was, we're really looking back in the pre-inflation era. We will go to slide 7. If you just focus on the left-hand graph here, which is the one titled General Relativity, so this is a typical picture. This is the typical justification of why you would choose the Bunch-Davies vacuum and why it doesn't really matter what time you do it. So the blue lines here are supposed to be some set of observable modes that sort of the range we're interested in. The red line would be the Hubble radius, which in GR is also essentially the same as the curvature radius. And the idea is that you put the Bunch-Davies vacuum for those modes at some time T onset when those modes are well inside the horizon, well inside the red line. And then you ask, well, what happens if I've chosen a different time, say T2, and moved it further back? Well, you see, so long as those blue lines are all still inside the horizon, it'll still be the Bunge-Davies vacuum and everything will be fine. Essentially, it means that for those modes, there hasn't been much particle creation, and the state is essentially the same. So, sort of heuristically, the justification that people have in the back of their mind for the Bunge-Davies vacuum is, well, provided the modes of interest, these observable modes, were always within the curvature scale, or were always within the Hubble horizon, then the Bunge-Davies vacuum is perfectly fine thing to do. And that is true, except that if you take that realistically, or you take that really seriously, what it means is you have to put the initial conditions as a singularity. And really, we have no idea what's going on down here, so the initial conditions sort of really do contain a big ambiguity. And we'll come back to the right-hand picture later on. So if we skip down to page 8. So really, the sort of take-home point for this whole section about standard inflation is that the observations are genuinely potentially at least sensitive to the state of the onset of slow roll. Okay, and that gives us a real window into this pre-inflation era that makes it possible to be able to see what happened in, say, a quantum gravity era. Okay, and I want to emphasize that the observations, this is an observational question, that it could be very important to be able to pinpoint things observationally. And that's in addition to the fact that there are these deep conceptual difficulties with inflation as a scenario that we should be able to solve within loop quantum gravity. And then just one point to note, that here I've been talking about the power spectrum and the tilt, which are the simplest things to get at, but you can go to higher order correlations. And in particular, the bispectrum, which gives you non-Gaussianities, will provide a really strong test of this initial state. In some sense, the power spectrum is sort of average over all k, whereas the non-Gaussianities give you a constraint for sort of almost every k. So it really is sort of orders of magnitude more information about the initial state. Okay. So we have a question here?
Sorry, maybe you can just clarify. Sometimes people think it's very fine-tuned to think that you can actually observe something about the initial state just because you require inflation to last, you know, nearly 60 folds, you require a special spectrum in the initial state. Can you just clarify what you think about that?
Right. So I think with the fine-tuning, so what we're going to see later on is that really we're just looking for consistency with the observations. And so we're looking for, so the first thing is to look for, is there any state that's consistent? I mean, that's the first non-trivial thing. And then the next question is that somehow difficult or fine-tuned or difficult to answer? And to sort of skip ahead a little bit, the end result comes out of it. It seems like it's very easy to get things that are consistent in a sort of the correct range. But actually, I think even the next slide, one of the difficult things to ask in GR is fine-tuning at all. I mean, probabilities and how that makes any sense of it. And even to ask the question is a bit ambiguous. And it's one of the things that the loop quantum cosmology it allows you to do very precisely is to ask the question very well and also how to answer it. We'll see that in a second. Any other questions? Okay, we'll go on to slide 9. So this is so that was all standard inflation. So now I'm going to sort of say, well, what do we want to try and do with inflation and loop quantum cosmology? And how does loop quantum cosmology do for some of these questions that we had for inflation? So we know that the background of the homogeneous loop quantum cosmology is extremely successful at solving a lot of the problems of inflation and a lot of the problems of GR in general. So perhaps most sort of profoundly is that the singularity becomes a bounce, which was always the hope that the quantum gravity would somehow solve this classical singularity, and it does. And it does it in a very precise and well-understood way. Equally non-trivially is the fact that at low densities you recover GR, and it turns out to be something that's very difficult to do in general, to try and you muck with the UV of GR and you usually screw up the IR. So this is a highly non-trivial thing. And then to go to this question that Sarah was asking, that so at the background level, if you have a scalar field and a potential, which we're arguing is not really in the remit of loop quantum cosmology to suggest why, but if you are given this, you will generically get inflation. And even generically here is something that's very precise. And this is work that David Sloan and Abhay Ashtekar did. And it is a genuinely very precise, well-defined meaning of probabilities. And it's 99.999%. And there were a lot of arguments backwards and forwards in general relativity about whether this is generic or not. And really the problem is that you can't even ask the question in a well-defined way in general relativity. There's a sort of dividing by infinity that's too ambiguous. The loop quantum cosmology does very well at the background level, and the questions we would like to ask are, if we can do all this again for including perturbations, how does it do? Okay, what type of questions are we looking to ask and answer? So the conditions to obtain inflation, well, we've seen in the background that works. Okay, generically we get inflation, but what about the state? What about the perturbations? If we can do perturbations in loop quantum cosmology, are we going to generically find that they agree with observations, which is exactly what Sarah was asking? And that's the question we're going to try and tackle here. The frequencies in inflation becomes transplanckian in general, so what happens to those? I mean, we should be able to understand them, and we should be able to see what's going on. The singularity, well, I mean, this is really a background thing which has been solved, but the equivalent problem for the perturbations is perturbation theory still good, say, at the bounds? I mean, are the energy density in the modes still comparable to the background? Are there still perturbations? Such like. So all these blue questions are things we're going to try and tackle here. And see what loop quantum cosmology can tell us about these. So if we go to slide number 10. So the basic program is to, first of all, we have to develop a framework to talk about perturbations in loop quantum cosmology. And we're going to here just take the most optimistic approximations, the sort of simplest approximations we could think of, which are really, we'll see a little bit later on exactly what this means, but it's really taking the standard constraints for the matter part for quantum field theory, which is essentially, if you like, something akin to the hybrid quantization, where we're going to say we're going to loop quantize the background and do something like a thought quantization of the perturbation mode. And this is obviously the sort of first go at this, and there's a longer-term program to see what happens if we start removing these approximations and make more direct contact to loop quantum gravity. But already at this level, this is a highly non-trivial thing to do, and there's some really kind of very interesting results that come out of this. In particular, to find that this works at all for any range of state, that we get something that's consistent is very exciting. And then we're going to go and use this, and we're going to explore what this says for the issues of inflation. Okay, we have this scenario of inflation, but it's kind of conceptually inconsistent, and we want to know, does this type of quantization of gravity sort of fix any of these inconsistencies? And we'll see that actually it does. So within that framework, what we're looking for is, first of all, consistency with observations. I mean, if it comes out and it's completely different to observations, then we really need to try harder. We also would like it to be free from all these issues of loop quantum gravity, which is probably asking a huge amount, but it's something that if we really believe this to be a quantum gravity theory, we should be aiming for. And then, okay, the last one is, and ideally, we would also like it to not be exactly the same as the predictions of GR. We would ideally like there to be some change which is potentially observable to make this sort of genuine prediction. And then finally, which is sort of where we go after we finish all this, is to start like unraveling some of these approximations and really understanding what they mean, what the consequences are, and where they came from, and how to do better. So the basic idea is to follow the sort of guiding principle that's always in loop quantum cosmology, which is you take full general relativity and you truncate it somehow. So in the isotropic homogeneous loop quantum cosmology that we've been doing for years, you take full general relativity and you impose homogeneity and isotropy, so that just truncates your full theory down to FRW type metrics, and you take the Hamiltonian of those and you loop quantize that. You do exactly the same thing for the anisotropic model. You impose the Bianchi symmetries, and you get to a Bianchi metric, you get the Bianchi Hamiltonian, and then you loop quantize that. And something very similar happens in the Gaudi models. You impose Gaudi symmetries, and you look at the Hamiltonian that's developed from that, and then you loop quantize that. And that's sort of orders, you know, that's a, this is an infinite degree of freedom system, so it's much more difficult, and this is where this hybrid quantization comes in, which is in very much the same spirit as what we're going to be doing. Okay, so we go to slide 11. So the first point we need to do we want to find a suitable truncation of general relativity, full general relativity, that includes background cosmology and perturbations on that background. And this is happily done for us by a couple of people, so it's laid out very nicely in the paper by David Langlois, and it's also done by Laura Bethke and other people. And here I'm going to be talking about this few slides. It's just full general relativity with a massive scalar field. And because we're going to be using the Hamiltonian formulation, this everything needs to be in a box, so we're going to take it as a torus so that it's flat, which for the most part we don't need to worry about, but it does lead to some very important conceptual questions later on. And the idea is to take the full phase space and just factor it into pieces that are purely homogeneous and purely inhomogeneous. And purely inhomogeneous here is very easy to find because we are in a torus, so we can do Fourier transforms, and this is just all but the zero mode. And then it turns out that both the symplectic structure and the Poisson brackets on these on this full phase space factor out, and really all that means in a practical level is that you get a canonical pair for the homogeneous modes, which is the ones you would normally use for homogeneous cosmology. And you also get canonical pairs for each mode in the inhomogeneous mode, and they don't really talk to each other. They require some brackets or commute. And then, of course, this is full general relativity. So in addition to the phase space, we also have all our constraints. In general, we're going to have a Gauss, a Diffeo, and a Hamiltonian constraint. And so this is what we need to impose. So if we go to slide number 12. So what we're actually interested in is not full general relativity, because it's too difficult for us. So we're going to look at what happens if these inhomogeneous modes are linear perturbations against the homogeneous background. And the way you do that is you build up all your constraints to second order in these inhomogeneities. So if you look at equation 5, this is sort of take any of your favorite constraint, and you write it as a piece that involves no inhomogeneous parts at all. Okay, so this is C0. This is just built out of the homogeneous mode. Then you take all the pieces that involve just a single term, so they are linear in the inhomogeneous term, so that's C1. And then you have to go to quadratic order, so you include you also add on anything that are quadratic in linear perturbations, or anything that has two of them. And you need to go to a quadratic order because when you take if you look for the equations of motion, you sort of lose one order, so that will give you linear equations of motion. And we want to look at this constraint and then carry out the reduction to the reduced phase space at first order. So what that really means is we want to solve the constraint to first order, which is this C1 is weakly zero, and then we want to find the gauge invariant variables on that reduced phase space. Okay. And once we've done that, the constraint, what's left over of the constraint, is going to give us the dynamics. So this is equation 6, and here the smearing function, or I sort of implicitly mean this is a lap. This is the homogeneous. This is going to be homogeneous. And so in addition to the fact that we've already solved the C1, so C1 is 0 because we solved the constraint, even if we hadn't, C1 wouldn't appear in this equation because we are smearing it with something homogeneous, and C1 is purely inhomogeneous. So if you integrate something purely inhomogeneous, you get 0. So this is all sort of straightforward, and it's in various papers. And one of the nice things about this is it's a very clean, very precise way of dealing with gauge, which can get a bit of a funny issue when you do cosmological perturbation theories that you see in most textbooks. So we go to page 13. So this is just a little bit more precise. This is one of the more technical slides here. So what variables do we actually have in the theory, say, before the reduction? So before the reduction, we have our connection variables, capital A, and then we have our triads, which are capital E. We also have a scalar field phi and its momenta pi phi. And we're expanding everything, all these things out as perturbations. So we're assuming there is a background piece, which is C, and then this is omega 0, which is complicated looking. But this is the standard piece that you have in loop quantum cosmology, the background connection. And then you have an alpha, which is the sort of first-order perturbations, first-order inhomogeneous pieces. Similarly, for the triads, you have your standard background piece, which is proportional. The P here is the only dynamic factor. And then you have a inhomogeneous piece, epsilon. And then, of course, we have our inhomogeneous pieces for our scalar field and its momenta, which are called delta phi and delta pi phi. So let's just do some counting. Let's find out how many sort of degrees of freedom we really should have at the end. So we have 7 constraints. So these are the 3 Diffeo, 3 Gauss, and 1 Hamiltonian constraint. The total number of configuration variables we have, these are constraints for the inhomogeneous variables. The number of inhomogeneous configuration variables we have. Well, we have 9 coming from the alphas because the superscript I runs from 1 to 3 and the subscript A runs from 1 to 3. And then we have our scalar field, which gives us 1, so that's 10. And then happily this is math that even I can do, so this is 1 plus 9 minus 7 constraints gives you 3 true inhomogeneous degrees of freedom. So if you like, those are the true inhomogeneous gauge invariant degrees of freedom. And these form, if you dive into these a little bit more and analyze them, you see that one of them is a scalar degree of freedom and the other two are tensor modes. And so the two tensor modes are the two helicities of the graviton. So what we're left with after we've done our reduction to the reduced phase space, we're left with the homogeneous degrees of freedom, which in the notation above would be C, P, phi, and pi phi, but when we do background loop quantum cosmology, it's much simpler to translate into variables which are V and B. So V here is something like the volume. So we have volume, it's the momenta B, phi and pi phi is our background variables, and then we have the inhomogeneous gauge invariant degrees of freedom, and I'm going to call the scalar ones, which is really all I'm going to look at here, as they're going to be called Q and P, it's momenta P, and you get one of these for each K mode, and then you would also have the two modes for the tensor perturbations. which actually tensor perturbations are much easier to work out, but I'm not going to talk about them in this talk. Okay, so we go to slide number 14.
Can I ask you something?
Yep.
When one does perturbation theory and has a background with a symmetry, there used to appear these extra constraints, the nonlinear stability constraints. Is that appearing here somewhere?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that the sort of nonlinear piece would come into this. I think by construction, you've assumed everything is only the linear terms appear in any of the constraints. So I think probably not.
Okay.
Okay, so we go to slide number 14. So when you write the Hamiltonian constraint, which is the one that's going to be most important to us, when you write down the Hamiltonian constraint in those variables, that's this equation at the top. So you have this piece here, which is the background part, which is exactly as in standard loop quantum cosmology. This is as in standard cosmology. This is the background Hamiltonian constraint. And then you have a piece, you know, integrating over all k-space, which looks like this. You have a p squared, a half p squared, some function of background pieces, f, which we'll come back to later. It's not super important. And then a q squared piece. And this is the Hamiltonian. This is the Hamiltonian constraint that we want to quantize. We want to go take to loop quantum cosmology. And just if you're sort of more familiar with cosmology type notation, then the V, the capital V here, really is like the volume of the torus. So you can think of it like a scale factor cubed, or it's the physical volume of the torus. And then just as a passing remark, you have to be careful when you do loop quantum cosmology with a scalar field, because what we want to do is deparameterized with respect to the scalar field, and for that to be a useful relational clock, you need it to be monatomic, and that's not true if you have a potential, right? It's going to roll up and roll back down again. So the idea here is we're going to use the quantum theory from the bounce up to some time later, say when the kinetic energy is equal to the potential energy, which happens maybe 10 to the 4 Planck seconds after the bounce, typically. And then after that, we want to just not have to worry about the loop quantum or the quantum gravity nature of things. And that's a very good approximation, because already by then, the curvature scale is down at 10 to the minus 10 of the Planck curvature. So this is just a practical thing that, you know, allows us to not worry about how we would go change our relational variables. But conceptually, there should be no difficulty in this. So the idea is we're going to try and quantize this whole constraint. We're going to see what happens, what loop quantum cosmology tells us about that. And then when we come to practically calculating things, we're going to use that up to some time until quantum field theory and curved space-time is a good approximation. And then we're going to go ahead with that. Okay, so we turn to slide 15. So this is really the take-home point, what I wanted to sort of say about this whole Hamiltonian perturbation thing. So everything we've done so far is classical. And equation 7 is the full Hamiltonian constraint. So this is what we want to quantize. And you take one look at that and you realize that you have the background part and everything else looks exactly like test scalar fields with a time-dependent map. I mean, if I hadn't told you that P or that Q was a perturbation variable and that it was, you would just look at it and say, well, it's just some scalar field. And the nice thing about this is we know how to do test scalar fields on a loop quantum cosmology background. Okay, this is what we'll talk about next, this quantum fields on a quantum background. And so we really should be able to apply that procedure directly to this. The only subtlety here is that this function f is this time-dependent mass function is not sort of simple. It's some complicated function, and so we might have to worry about how we deal with that in detail, and we'll talk about that a bit later. And the last thing to note is that the tensor modes are all... Was there a question?
Yeah, just a quick question. Is there just one Hamiltonian constraint, as in the homogeneous case, or do you have to now consider an infinite number of Hamiltonian constraints?
So there's only one, but there's only one in the sense that the right-hand side is really an integral over all k. So if you wanted to separate it out into all k and write it explicitly, then you would have sort of infinitely many terms. The question is, first of all, I should say infinitely many terms. Really what happens in practice is we're going to be interested in a finite range of k. We're going to be interested in the observable range of k, which allows us to eliminate sort of most of the questions that might be difficult about dealing with that. But that's something that we can actually tackle, and you can ask sort of really correctly questions about what happens as k goes to infinity, what happens as k approaches the size of the box. But as far as the number of constraints goes, this is the constraint. This is the only constraint there is.
So maybe I missed something, but this is the constraint with n taken homogeneous, But in the theory, aren't there also constraints with an arbitrary and homogeneous function?
Right, you're right. So this is part of the problem about doing the perturbation theory from, say, the four-dimensional point of view, that it looks like you should be able to do that and build gauge invariant variables out of that. But when you write it down like this, it really is that the lapse is homogeneous. Okay, I mean, it really is. And the reason is, let's see if I can go back to this. So let's see. If you go back to slide 12. It really is that you've solved the constraint. The only place the inhomogeneous lapse could appear. So if you had an inhomogeneous lapse and you smeared it and you were smearing your background Hamiltonian with it, that would automatically be zero because this background piece vanishes. The only place that inhomogeneous lapse could come in would be when it multiplies C1, which is zero because we solved the constraint. So really the inhomogeneous piece genuinely doesn't appear in here anywhere, and it is only the homogeneous part.
Okay. Yeah, let me just amplify early. Will is talking about slide number 12 and equation number 6 on the slide number 12. And there we got lapse multiplied by C0, which is a homogeneous, I mean the background constraint, plus C2. Now the point is, the point that you are raising is that aren't there also additional constraints which will correspond to inhomogeneous lapse because we have got inhomogeneous perturbation fields up here. But if I did the expansion around the background, I got, so to say, the background fields, then I got first order fields, which are purely inhomogeneous, then I got second order fields. And so you have to do the expansion. And so there is a competition between, or there is a two different things that we have to look at. We have to look at terms which are quadratic in the first-order perturbations and also terms which have to do with second-order perturbations. So the inhomogeneous constraint that you are interested in actually turn out to constrain the second-order perturbation. But here we are only looking at the first-order perturbation and their evolution.
Yes, that's clear. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
So that's why there is no, so we don't have to worry about this additional constraint. They will constrain only the second order one, which we are not looking at here. We are only looking at the perturbations, which are first order perturbations and dynamics of them. And so we don't have to worry.
It would be there the higher order.
Exactly.
Great, thank you.
And do the gauge invariant variables take care of the diffeomorphism constraint too?
Yes.
Okay.
Hello.
Okay, any other questions?
Yeah, I've got a question. I mean, how do you reconcile the fact that Newtonian potential is considered to be perturbation of the time-time component of the metric in space-time picture? But if lapse is not perturbed, then how do we see the origin of Newtonian potential?
This is one of the difficulties. This is why I was saying that the Hamiltonian formulation is some sense much cleaner than the four-dimensional version. So part of the reason, if you do the four-dimensional version and you look for gauge invariant variables, you will find what looks like many more of them. You'll find vector modes and you'll find two scalar modes and so forth. But when you really look into it, it turns out that those aren't actually, half of those are not dynamical. Half of those, so there are no vector modes and half of the scalar modes are constrained by the constraint equations of GR. To get to the Newtonian potential, what you would have to do is you would write down these gauge invariant variables, and then you would look at them in a particular gauge. You would write down the four-dimensional metric, and then you would say, I'm going to look at these gauge invariant variables in a particular gauge where it corresponds to, say, the Newtonian gauge. So once you have the gauge invariant variables, you can sort of choose to look at them in a different gauge if you want. The difficulty about doing it the other way is to decide whether or not this gauge invariant variable is really physical in the first place, which is what leads to the difficulty.
But shouldn't have a problem with the equivalent space and I'm going back again, because, I mean, usually the way we see that, I mean, we always try to see that one of the gauge invariant variable in the perturbation theory of in the phonological background is Newtonian potential. And like that is used in many ways, actually. So would that be a problem, and why is not?
So I think not. I mean, I think if you want to think of the four-dimensional version, the most natural link to this would be to just choose a gauge, or to look for a metric in which you've chosen the gauge to be the lapse to be homogeneous and the shift to be homogeneous, and that's a perfectly good gauge to use. And then that would sort of correspond very directly to all these equations. The thing is that this tells you immediately that those what the equations you get from that, those are the sort of physical degrees of freedom. But of course, from a four-dimensional point of view, you can then choose to rewrite those gauge invariant variables in a different gauge, and so you can go back. Here, you don't have to worry about this. In the Hamiltonian formulation, you don't have to worry about it just because you're guaranteed that you have the full phase space. It has all the degrees of freedom in it. You have the full constraint, so it has it's constraining all the degrees of freedom correctly. So automatically, whatever is supposed to be dealt with will be dealt with. It is very subtle to see from a four-dimensional point of view, from the sort of standard textbook perturbation theory way, what's happening and how this relates to that. These are sort of quite difficult questions. But you can be sure at least that the Hamiltonian formulation takes care of everything, including how to get the potential back out. Yes, so Abhay just said the other thing, a very nice check at the end is that when you finish this whole thing and you write down the equations of motion, that is exactly the Mokonov equation. So you do this whole thing and you get to the end and you get exactly the Mokonov equation, which is what you get in the standard cosmology way.
Okay.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, so we were on slide 15. And the only thing I wanted to mention is in passing is I'm not talking about the tensor modes, but they follow exactly the same way and are in fact simpler to do. So you're looking at those are the first ones to look at. But I'm going to go to slide 16 now. So I'm going to be very quick going through this section on QFT and cosmological quantum spacetimes because there are many more experts in the audience than I am. But the basic idea is that you can ask how do you do test scalar fields on a background. And you say you work, that's a truncation of GR that you can write down on a cosmological background. It's a truncation of GR you write down the Hamiltonian, and then you get equation 8. This is just saying that the physical states should satisfy equation 8, which is really saying the physical state should be annihilated by that constraint. So the left-hand side is we've deparameterized with respect to a scalar field. This theta operator, or if you like the H02 operator, squared operator, is really the difference operator of loop quantum cosmology. If you like, that's the background geometry part. And then the H tau is really the scalar field part. Okay, so you have so many scalar fields labeled by K, and then you have so many scalar fields P and Q. You Fourier transform them into their modes, and then you ask how do they? This is their Hamiltonian. And here equation 8 is written in harmonic time, basically for reasons in a minute that translating into relational time. We go to slide 17. The idea is now to make a series of systematic approximations, which are all sort of versions of the test field approximation. We're assuming these are test fields, and these are all three specific assumptions that need to be made, which are consistent with that idea, but these are the ones we need. The first is you assume that the state can be factorized. So the full state is obviously depends on the background geometry as well as these matter fields, and you assume that the state can be factorized as a tensor product of the two, where you have a background part, which depends only on the geometry, and then you have a perturbation part, which depends on everything. Then you assume you can take expectation values with respect to this geometry part of the state. In essence, that's the sort of saying what we're interested in is working out what happens to the perturbation part of the state relative to the background. And then you also make this approximation that this geometry is sharply peaked around some state, and sharply peaked in a very precise sense that, you know, powers of expectation values are the same as expectation values. On the third point, I should have expectation values here. Is not an operator equation. The only thing to sort of keep in mind is that you could get funny operators, you could get inverse operators, inverse connections, inverse volumes appearing if you in your matter Hamiltonian, and this procedure will account for all of those corrections. And the nice thing about it is you can unwrap the approximations one by one. You can go and check, does the last approximation hold? Is it really valid? What would be the next order in the approximation and so forth? Okay, so we go to slide 18. This is really just sort of implementing those ideas. So I'll be very quick. The slide 9 is really approximately the square root of the constraint. Okay, and you need to be able to take that square root. You need to make sure that it really is sort of, in some sense, the background Hamiltonian is the bit that dominates. But you can do that, and you can do this in a very precise way and check that this other perturbation operator is well defined. perturbation Hamiltonian is well defined, and the whole piece on the right hand side is in essence a Hamiltonian with respect to this relational time phi. And that's fantastic. This is looking very like what you would see in normal quantum field theory. The only problem is that there are terms in there which are like geometry, background geometry operators, like a to the fourth and so forth as an operator. And these don't depend on time, whereas we're used to thinking in a cosmological setting that they are variables that are not time independent. So to get sort of the link a bit stronger, you go to the interaction picture. And then you finally get to the equation right at the bottom, which is in this interaction picture, which is a simple Schrodinger equation for Hamiltonian of the perturbation. And this brings us essentially right back to QFT in curved spacetime. So if we go to slide 19. So the last thing to make is, so far this has all been on a sort of general state, albeit in the interaction picture. So now we make the approximation, we can take the tensor product, and we do this expectation value with respect to the background. And finally we arrive at equation 10. And this really is the sort of Schrodinger equation for scalar fields Q, but moving on some effective background. Okay, so rather than the background being given by scale factor A, it's really given by its expectation value. And you can also see here that it's exactly in here that this sharply peaked approximation comes. Okay, so this is all was written down in 2009 by Ashtekar, Kaminsky, and Landowski, and it's sort of a very very precise way of going from of loop quantizing a system which is cosmological background with scalar fields, test scalar fields on it. Okay, so we go to slide 20. And I wanted you to just recall that the classical Hamiltonian we wrote down before, which I've rewritten in equation 11, is exactly of this form. I mean, it is exactly a background piece plus something which, if I hadn't told you were perturbations, you'd think were scalar fields. The only funny thing about it is the mass is really this function f of background, and this function I've now written out for you is in equation 12. And you see it's not super pleasant, okay? I mean, it's a bit complicated. But these are all operators that we can at least tackle, okay? You can actually ask what they look like and so forth. And it's not as bad as it could be because you see in the denominators, which are obviously all the inverse operators are always going to be sort of where the difficulties arise, they really always appear in the form as VB or V squared, which is really the Hamiltonian constraint or the background Hamiltonian constraint or the square root. So it's not as bad as it could be, and in fact, we don't need to worry about it most of the time because we're really only interested in taking expectation values and then neglecting fluctuations anyway. So we can deal with all the sort of subtleties that would be in defining 12 as an operator. Okay, so we go to slide 21. Really, the take-home point from all this is that up to fluctuations, we can really get back to standard QFT. But the difference is it's the standard QFT Hamiltonian on an effective loop quantum cosmology background. And a couple of things I want to note in passing here, that this is true only for the Hamiltonian written in the correct form, okay? I mean, classically you can start playing, you can change H squared, Hubble parameter squared with density as much as you want, but in loop quantum cosmology these two things are different, so you have to be careful. And this is sort of getting at what we were talking about before, that this is all starting with the Hamiltonian formulation, and that it's not exactly crucial in that you can do this from a four-dimensional point of view, at least classically, not the quantum field piece. But it leads to very sort of difficult questions interpreting gauge and finding out what exactly is physical. So really starting from the Hamiltonian formulation is the way to do it. And then there's a systematic series of approximations that you make. You start by truncating the classical theory, which is really the loop quantum cosmology approximation, and then you make these three approximations, and it takes you to loop quantum cosmology of these test scalar fields on in the assumption that the background is very semi-classical. Okay, so we'll go to slide 22. So that was really all the machinery. We've sort of built up the formulation. Let's ask, see if we can answer any of these questions we had at the beginning. So let's see the Trans-Planckian frequency. So this is a problem for GR that there are observational modes in the CMB that we see that would have been Trans-Planckian frequency. And we don't really want to trust QFT on GR classical background, just the Trans-Planckian frequency. But here we have a Hamiltonian that includes, in principle, all the quantum geometry effects. Okay, so there's nothing, and Trans-Planckian frequencies occur, but there's absolutely nothing wrong with them. They're completely fine. What this Hamiltonian, this constraint is telling us is that it's not the frequencies of an individual mode that we should worry about, it's the total energy density. Okay, I mean, the total energy density in a mode is bounded by this constraint. And that might sound a bit odd that you can have arbitrarily high frequency modes, but the total energy density somehow is the thing to worry about. But if you just think about the background, okay, background standard loop quantum cosmology, the momentum of the scalar field is not bounded, okay? It can be arbitrarily large. point is that the spectrum of that operator and the spectrum of the volume operator are not independent. That there are no physical states which has a sufficiently large eigenvalue of that operator along with a sufficiently small value of the volume operator so as to make the energy density larger than the critical energy density. But really what we see in the background is the kinetic energy is bounded by this critical energy density, but the momentum itself is not. And that is exactly what's happening in this QFT language. There's the note at the bottom which says that this sort of solves, in a sense, the Trans-Planckian problem in the sense that for the observable modes, we don't have to worry about it. Everything works out fine for us. However, there is sort of a deeper conceptual question that asks, well, what about if I was considering modes as k genuinely goes to infinity or k becomes arbitrarily large? I mean, what really happens to the spectrum up there? Those are conceptual questions that really need to be answered. But even then, sort of the question itself has been much more refined by writing it in this group quantum cosmology language. We have a much more precise understanding of what it is that we want to solve and why. Okay, we go to slide 23. So what about perturbation theory? I mean, this is a question we had in inflation, that if you go back towards the singularity, why should perturbation theory be valid? And here, this is the same question. Sorry, was there a question? So here we have the same question, okay? We're assuming perturbation theory is valid at late times, but what happens at the bounce? I mean, is it really true that the energy density in these perturbations at the bounce is small compared to the background? And that turns out to be a very subtle question. And it's a subtle question in the sense that there are a lot of ambiguities surrounding the definition of total energy in any quantum field theory. Okay? I mean, you need to renormalize things, and what happens and what renormalization procedure you use. And how, in this sense, how you would choose to interpret that renormalization is quite subtle. But let me just say the sort of simplest thing that we can sort of really be sure of, that if you use adiabatic regularization and you take the simplest vacuum state that you could think of, which is what I'm going to do, then indeed these perturbations are perturbations even at the bounds. So the energy density in these perturbations is small compared to the energy density of the background. And that in itself is a highly non-trivial thing that needn't have happened. I mean, it might well have happened that wasn't true, and in which case everything we've done is just not incorrect, you just don't trust the approximation. But happily for at least this very simple case, that the approximations do appear to be consistent. Okay, so in the last few minutes, we'll go to slide 4. I'm going to talk about some sort of actual results that we can see this is sort of in action. So the idea is in standard inflation, The procedure is you assume that you have a scalar field and a potential, and we're going to do the same. Then in standard inflation, you would set something like a natural vacuum for the perturbations at some time t onset. And instead, we're just going to say, the natural time to do that inflation would be the singularity, but you can't do that there. Whereas here, we have the natural time would be the bound, so we'll just put it there and see what happens. Then we're going to evolve that whole state forward and calculate the late time power spectrum and see what it looks like. Is it consistent with observation? We go to slide 25. I really want to sort of... This is sort of a conceptual interlude. I wanted to emphasize that we're not trying to say that loop quantum cosmology necessarily needs inflation. I mean, there's a whole pre-balanced phase, and maybe there's some other completely new mechanisms for creating the perturbations without inflation at all, which would in some sense be very nice. But we're not sort of asking or even considering that question. We're just saying, can loop quantum gravity solve some of the issues that inflation is facing? And so that's our kind of conceptual prejudice. So the parameters we've got to set up are the inputs. We've got to set up the background parameters. So at the bounce, they give you the value of the field and the value of the mass of the inflaton. And then we're going to be looking at the modes between some range, which corresponds to the observable range of k, and I give you the state of those modes at those k. Okay. And the question we want to ask are, look, first of all, is there any state we can write down which is compatible with observation? If there is that compatibility somehow generic? Is it difficult? Is it sort of something that we have to sort of really struggle to make consistent? And then lastly, we'd like to know, are there any potential observables? So if we go to slide 26, so this is where I'm going to spend basically the rest of the talk. So this graph is a lot on it. So the red line at the bottom is if you just did standard inflation, okay? We set the Bunch-Davies vacuum at some time t onset, and we calculate the power spectrum. And you see it's almost flat. That's the almost scale invariant. It's not quite flat. It's actually tilted, and that's exactly the spectral thing. The blue line is if we do exactly what I described a second ago. We put sort of the natural, in some sense, the most naive version of a vacuum at the bounce, and you evolve that state forward. Okay. And what you see here is on the right-hand side of the graph, the two lines, the vertical axis here is log of the power spectrum, and the horizontal axis is log of the mode k in t timescales. And we see on the right-hand side of the graph, these two lines coincide perfectly, which just means that for all the right-hand side of the graph, everything is consistent. Now, you might worry the left-hand side, oh, it looks like it's very different, and it is very different. Now, we can't conclude from that that things are inconsistent, or because it could be that one of our approximations that we've made along the way is sort of starting to break down, and really this is just a sign that perturbation theory is getting bad. Okay. But, you know, nevertheless, the thing I want you to focus on is that for a whole range of k's and k's getting sufficiently large, everything is consistent. So the thing you want to know from this to be able to sort of really compare it to observation is what is k star? I mean, the red line is evaluated at some particular value k star. And because of our normalization conventions, k star on this graph is variable. It depends on what my initial conditions were. So it depends in particular on what the value of phi was at the bounds. In essence, it tells you that how much expansion was there before the beginning of inflation. And the little table on the top shows you that provided, say, phi bounce is bigger than 1.2. So say if phi bounce was 1.2, k star would fall at about 4 or 4.2 on this graph. And then that's where we'd be measuring, and that would be perfectly consistent. And in fact, the CMB, really, the WMAP really measures some range of k, which is about 2 orders of magnitude bigger and half an order of magnitude smaller. So, and even that total range would be completely consistent. Okay. And what you want to take away from is that 1.2 is not a big number, and anything bigger than that will also be consistent. So really, we didn't have to try very hard at all to get this consistency. Okay, we just needed to make sure that phi bounce was bigger than 1 and a bit, and everything is perfectly consistent. Okay.
The range of phi bounce is minus a million.
Yeah, and so Abhay is just pointing out that the range of phi bounce goes up to a million or 10 to the 6 or something. It depends a little bit on the value of mass, but it can get very, very large. I mean, we're talking about only the very, very small end of it and only a very small part of it. The other thing I should point out is that this blue graph is really kind of independent of the value of phi bounce. It doesn't change if you change the value of phi at the bounce, and it doesn't really change if you change the mass either. So it's kind of a universal graph. And just before I wrap up with the conclusions, if we go to slide 27, I'll go back to this picture I had before. If we now look at the right-hand side, you can kind of see why what might be happening. Okay, so there's a radius of curvature here, it's the dotted line. And what you see is that for modes that are sufficiently, wavelength is sufficiently short, that's sufficiently large k, so the right-hand side of the graph we had a second ago, they are inside this radius of curvature even at the bounds. And then they remain inside the radius of curvature. So for those modes, the Bunch-Davies vacuum is a perfectly good vacuum, and that is in essence what the state we took was. So for those, you would expect everything to be consistent. But if you go to larger wavelengths, which is smaller k, you start to get modes which are comparable to the radius of curvature at the bounds, and those are where things start to change, where you start to get deviations. So we can even understand sort of the scale of where this consistency happens and what causes it and how it works about. Okay, and so I'm just going to wrap up with the conclusions on slide 28. So what I really want to emphasize is that there is this framework which we have, which allows us to do a consistent theory of inflation, which includes the quantum gravity era. Okay, so it really wraps up, at least at one level, all the conceptual questions that were difficult you had with inflation. And that's sort of, if you're happy to restrict yourself to a finite range of k. The sort of very pleasant thing which we weren't really expecting is that the simplest initial state you could have thought of is consistent with the observational data for almost all values of phi bounce and n. Okay, I mean, you really need to make the mass extremely high to change this, and the value of phi bounce, anything other than the very smallest it could possibly be, will be consistent. And then sort of nicely, but more sort of difficult to quantify, is the fact that the power spectrum is altered. It's not exactly the same as you would have got from standard inflation. The differences are small, which is good because it's consistent, but it means there are potential observables there. And in particular, we think non-Gaussianities will really try and hone this down. And so those are the sort of the big conclusions I want to emphasize, that we have this whole framework where we can do everything in inflation consistently, and we can ask the questions that people have sort of been avoiding for 30 years in inflation. And that in addition to that, it was actually remarkably easy to find something that was observationally consistent. Now, there are a lot of conceptual questions left over. Okay, and often what's happened here is that the conceptual questions the naive conceptual questions that you had in inflation have been solved, but they've been replaced by sort of much more subtle, much more precise conceptual questions. And so those are the things we're going to look at next. So for example, is this deviation from the standard case of inflation something physical, or is it due to approximations breaking down? Ideally, you'd want something more of a deep connection back to loop quantum gravity for the Hamiltonian. For the matter part, so that would be, that's sort of the zeroth order approximation we put in at the very beginning. We would like to try and improve that. If you can do that, you might be able to say something very specific about the initial state. But perhaps the best one, the easiest one to tackle and the most profound as far as quantum field theory goes is you can now remove this restriction to a finite range of K. You can ask what happens if I allow all ranges of K. I mean, am I really talking about K modes up to infinite frequencies? Is there some natural cutoff? How does this affect renormalization and so on? Okay, and I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Hi, this is Gulam Hussain again. I have a question. What happened to the diffeomorphism? How did you solve it?
Say that again?
What happened to the diffeomorphism constraint?
So I see
in 915 you do perturbation, but after that, how do you solve the diffeomorphism?
So in essence, the diffeomorphism constraint sort of comes for free. Because the background is sort of automatically diffeomorphism invariant. I'm saying this wrong. I should say really that it's just gauge fixed from the very beginning. You by writing it down in a variable like this, you get the diffeo constraint. That and the fact that you've done a Fourier transform in a box, a coordinate box.
Oh, so you say just gauge fixed.
Yeah, basically. I mean, exactly like you do in normal cosmology, that there is no Diffeo constraint in normal cosmology because you've chosen to write it down in some coordinate.
More questions?
Hello?
Go ahead.
Yes, this is very good work. It's great to see it. Do you have anything to say about the non-Gaussianities, or will you be able to make a statement about the non-Gaussianities sometime in the near future?
So we hope so. I mean, let me put it this way. In principle, there is nothing in what we've done that's restricted to the power spectrum. In principle, everything can be redone. I mean, we have the full state, so you can go and calculate what the bispectrum looks like and calculate exactly the non-Gaussianities. The difficulty in doing it is really just a technical one, that it gets very computationally challenging to be able to keep track of everything. And then also that exactly how you parameterize it so as to compare to cosmological data is something that's non-trivial, which is difficult to do. But it's exactly what we're working on now. We think, yes, we'll be able to say something sort of very precise about it shortly, hopefully.
Very good. Thank you.
So I have a question, Will. If you go back to slide 26, what I seem to be seeing here is that the higher the value of the scalar field of the bounds, the better the agreement you're getting with classical GR predictions. So this seems to me to be very counterintuitive, because what seems to be happening then is that the higher the value of the scalar field, the more the magnification, the more inflation you're getting. And so I would have thought the bigger the scalar field, the more you would hit Transplanckian issues. But here you seem to be saying sort of the opposite, that quantum gravity effects become smaller I would have thought they would become much larger.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It is very counterintuitive. And you also hit it on the head that what it says on the very right-hand side of that those tables, that when the wavelength of the mode is less than a Planck length, then things start to look a lot more like GR. And so the reason for that, and it is a very odd thing, but the reason for that, if you go to slide 27, and you look at this right-hand graph, what it's saying is that the smallest wavelength modes, so the ones that are less than a Planck scale at the bounds, inside the curvature scale. But really the reason that that's possible and the reason that works is that the frequency of the modes themselves is not an issue. It doesn't matter how Transplanckian they get. Unless they get to sort of 10 to the 150 times the Planck, Planck frequency, then we don't have any problems. And really what's the potential issue there is, are they perturbations? Is the energy density in those modes small compared to the background? And for these observational ranges, everything's fine. But really it is odd to think that the sort of quantum gravity effects come in at the larger scales, which is when they're comparable to the curvature scale.
Right, and so this is sort of going to be a conceptual issue, or at least a practical issue, when you come to make any prediction or measurement in this the number of available data points for these very, very long wavelengths, the ones that you're going to say are going to be largely effective, is very, very small, right?
Absolutely. And worse than that, you immediately run into cosmic variance, so the data is also very poor there. So absolutely, that'll be a practical problem. I think that's a huge problem and will be a big problem for the power spectra. The problem is less so for the non-Gaussianities. Not that that's not a problem, it's just that there is somehow more potential data there because you have more correlations between different k's.
And if I might, do these also extend to the tensor modes? Do you expect something similar, or is there any reason to?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, we did all this for tensor modes first. It's just, so it's everything goes through exactly the same, basically. And it's just that at the end of the day, you don't have anything to compare it to for tensor modes, so you don't know if you're right. But yeah, tensor modes can be done.
Yeah, sure. Okay, thank you very much.
While you're mentioning the tensor modes, when you say you don't know if you're right, did you have a prediction for the magnitude of tensor modes as a function of the m squared in the scalar field or something like that?
Yeah, actually, so that's one of the things we wrote down, was that, so if you go back to slide 26, so when we saw this first and we didn't know, what we saw first was the left-hand side of the graph, and so we thought, oh, God, things aren't consistent. But one of the funny things is it turns out it's exactly the same thing for the tensor modes, and so it doesn't change the tensor to scalar ratio at all. Even on the left-hand side. And then we realized the right-hand side is actually consistent, and essentially the tensor mode graph looks very similar, just shifted down by a couple of orders of magnitude.
Okay, so you have no new prediction for the tensor to scalar ratio?
No, unfortunately not. I have to say that certainly for the right-hand side of the graph, that will be exactly the same as GR. The left-hand side of the graph, that will depend a lot on whether or not this deviation turns out to be something physical, or if its deviation turns out to be something we need to try a bit harder to extract the physics from. But at the moment, no.
Okay.
More questions? Okay, let's thank William again.